Many of our listeners would perceive space activities as something remote from their lives. The space show seeks to remedy this. Another way to reduce that remoteness is to visit a museum at which space artifacts and models are displayed. One of Australia's most exciting museums is Sydney's Powerhouse in Ultimo. Andrew Rennie speaks to Kerry Doherty, curator of space technology at the Powerhouse Museum.
Good afternoon, Kerry. Welcome to Southern FM.
Hello, Andrew. Nice to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
At the Powerhouse in Sydney, you have a number of space exhibits. What are they?
Well, the space exhibition is actually only one of about 25 major exhibitions at the Powerhouse, which cover the field from science and technology through decorative arts and even social history. The Powerhouse has a rather unique combination by including all these different subject areas. The space exhibition itself is also rather unique. Actually, I shouldn't say that. It's a bit of a tautology, isn't it? It is unique in being the only space exhibition in the world, as far as we're aware, which combines material from the three superpowers, that is, space-related material. We have items on display from the People's Republic of China, as well as the Soviet Union and the United States.
Yes, I've noted that actually in a number of museums overseas, they're concentrated on just that one country, usually the host country.
Yes, either that or you have, there's the one side of the story. It's either telling you the Russian side of the story if they happen to be an Eastern Bloc museum, or the American side of the story if they happen to be a Western museum. I have visited a few museums in Europe which do include both the Soviet and the American, but I've never met anyone else or seen any other museum that's also included the Chinese. And we thought that that was very important because, after all, China is an up-and-coming space power in our area. And we felt that it was important that Australians should be aware of China's involvement with space activity.
Yes, you have quite a number of Chinese artefacts there. What are they?
We have a 1/12 scale model of the Long March 3 rocket. Also, models of two of China's earliest satellites, Dongfang Heng 1, and pardon my Chinese, which was in fact China's first satellite, launched in 1970, and also Dongfang Heng 2, which was their first geostationary communications satellite, which was launched in 1984, if my memory serves me correctly. Also, we have some rather lovely Chinese space souvenirs. The Chinese particularly have produced, you know, some beautiful souvenir plates and things which relate to their space program, which are very, very lovely and delicate. And also some rather interesting examples of the very earliest rocketry. That is, of course, as most people would know, rocketry in the form of sky rockets, firework rockets, was developed in China anything up to 1,000 years ago. And some of the earliest uses for skyrockets, apart from just fireworks, were for rocket-powered weapons, what you might call very primitive terror devices. And the Chinese government actually made for us some beautiful reproductions of some of these very early rocket-powered devices, one of which is my favourite. It's called the Flying Dragon Out of Water. It's a large bamboo tube with a carved dragon's head and tail and a series of rockets which stick out from the base in such a way that they look like the dragon's legs. And the idea is that these rockets would be lit, and of course, the just like a firework, like a skyrocket, the dragon would leap into the air. But then it had two harpoons in its mouth, which were also connected to fireworks. And when the legs burned out, the leg rockets burned out, they ignited the wicks for the harpoons in the mouth, and then these would fire out straight at the enemy. Now, I mean, the thing was probably grossly inaccurate, and half the time probably wouldn't do more than jump up into the air and fall back on the ground, but it would certainly frighten the living daylights out of an opposing warrior rushing towards it who'd never seen fireworks before.
It certainly would.
I think it would frighten the living daylights out of anyone now, actually.
Now, Australia plans to use one of the Long March rockets for launching OSAT.
Yes, that's right. Coming up early next year, I believe, the launch has now been pushed back to...
Which model of Long March will that be?
Long March 4, as I understand it. And we are, in fact, hoping that the Chinese government will, in fact, provide us with an updated Long March model for the exhibition.
Oh, splendid. I understand that the model that you have there is not quite the same one that's going to be launched by the Chinese. What's the model that you do have there of OSSET?
Right, currently we have one of the first generation or A generation of OSSET satellites, and that's a full-size model too, so it's about 18 feet. Sorry, I'm not metric when it comes to some of these things.
We'll forgive you.
Yes, but it's about 18 feet, and we have it hanging from the ceiling in the attitude that OSSET actually orbits in its geostationary location around the Earth. But, in fact, we also hope to upgrade that next year with continuing sponsorship from the Hughes Aircraft Company, who very kindly sponsored our first replica, and so that then we'd have the upgraded OSSET and the upgraded Long March both on display.
That would make be quite unique in the world, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes, we think so.
Now, the Soviets have a number of objects on display. Are any of them actual flight hardware? Are they all simulations?
No, a couple of them are. We have a full-size re-entry capsule for the Soyuz spacecraft, and although the capsule is a reproduction, the spacesuits inside, that is the crew inside, are wearing real spacesuits. And right next to that exhibit, we have a display case which contains an interesting variety of Soviet space food and the types of medical and hygiene equipment that the cosmonauts use, and also an original glove that was worn by cosmonaut General Vladimir Zhenebekov on his fourth space flight. And it has an interesting little story attached to it. If you ever visit the museum, you'll see there's a watch on the glove. And according to cosmonaut Zhenebekov, it never worked. And they used to wear American watches on their other wrist.
Well, we better not get into that sort of talk. Now, there's a strange wheeled vehicle there. It seems to have about... eight wheels, I think, and a large lid. What is that?
Yeah, that's our Lunokhod. That is the moonwalking robot, as the which is the direct translation, actually. Lunokhod was a Soviet moon probe. There were two, one sent to the moon in 1970 and another in 1973. They were remotely controlled probes. That is, there was an operator on Earth who drove this thing like a remote controlled tank almost across the surface of the moon. And they're quite remarkable vehicles. The unfortunately, their biggest drawback apparently was the reaction time and the difficulty of actually controlling it from the Earth, because you have a 2.5 second delay either way with the signals going to and from the Earth to the Moon.
Did they have any mishaps from that?
Yes, they did. Lunokhod 2 actually came to grief because its operator back on Earth couldn't react fast enough when it ran up over a boulder.
Oh, I remember reading many years ago that they actually... The driver of the Lunokhod was actually a taxi driver roped off the streets of Moscow.
No. In fact, an interesting story that I heard from one of the Soviet delegates who came out to help us install that part of the exhibition was that, in fact, the pilots or drivers, however you like to call them, were qualified test pilots. And the task of manipulating the Lunokhod, there were actually five people who were involved in the driving of Lunokhod. But the task was so arduous that, in fact, they used to change the crews something like every 4 hours. That was about all that anybody could take because of the difficulty of maintaining both one's concentration and having to react in slow motion, as it were, to things that had already happened on the moon.
How was it powered?
pardon me. Solar cells and batteries for the lunar night when there were no immediate solar power available. The big lid that you're referring to, of course, if you look closely, you'll see it's all covered with blue solar cells. And that would flip up during the lunar day, or 14 Earth days of sunlight, and then close down during the lunar night to help keep the interior of the craft warm. In fact, I have to admit, we at the museum tend to refer to it as the ambulatory toilet seat because it tends to look a little bit that way with the lid flipped up.
Yes, I had noted the resemblance, actually. How did it find its way around the moon? I mean, how did the operator in Moscow know where to drive the thing? I mean, how did they avoid craters and things like that?
It had a pair of stereo movie cameras or TV cameras on the front of the craft. It also had radar sensors as well that enabled them to, you know, get a picture of the terrain. But I gather that what made it particularly difficult was that the television cameras were of the slow scan variety, so that it took time to build up a picture back on Earth. And the quality of it wasn't particularly high into the bargain, so it actually made it very difficult for the driver to see what was actually in front of him, particularly at times when the lunar shadows were at angles that were not particularly helpful for differentiating the terrain in front of you. And of course that's why the driver didn't see the boulder coming when he ran up over it and tipped the lunar cot over.
Well, Kerry, thank you very much for coming with us tonight.
That's okay, my pleasure.
That was Andrew Rennie in conversation with Kerry Doherty, Curator of Space Technology, Powerhouse Museum, Sydney. Entry to the museum is free.